Silence!
Oppenheimer!
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
This is Nerd Prey Radio!
Nerd alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 66 of Nerd Pride Radio. 66 was the number of the order, Order 66, instructing the clone troopers to kill all of the Jedi. So ask me how I'm doing today. Go on, ask me. I am awesome! My name is Mike Jones. I am a D&D nerd. D&D/Pathfinder nerd, I should write that down. History nerd, sci-fi nerd, a comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, comedy nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd, plus there's probably like seven other kinds of nerd I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You are listening to Nerd Pride Radio, the place I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff that just won't fit in my head anymore. Our sponsor this week is Big Kahuna Burger. Big Kahuna. This is a tasty burger. Which brings us right to the meticulously plotted portion of this podcast. This is the time for me when I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. If something strikes me as interesting during the course of my busy, busy week, I add it to my master list, and the best stuff off that list gets spewed out all over you guys every week when I record. You lucky dogs. So, straight into that master list. First, it must be time for a little feedback. Oh, Mrs. Darks. Hi, Mrs. Darks. My dungeon master is DM Darks, and creatively named DM Darks, and his wife, Mrs. Darks, has been on our site very occasionally, once in a while. She's apparently wonderful and amazingly supportive because she continues to let her husband run the Pathfinder game for us that we're in. Even though I'm sure it's amazingly time-consuming, it makes all of us happy, and we are so appreciative that she is supportive of that. But apparently, I did not realize she is also a listener of this podcast, or at least has been in recent weeks. And you'll also notice I'm trying really hard not to say so much. It's really tough. I keep catching myself doing it, and then every time I do, I have to stop and pause, and I think about what I'm doing. I lose my train of thought. But I was listening to some of my earlier podcasts, and I realized that a couple of years ago, I finally broke myself of that habit. But then I took that long year off, and I haven't gotten back to it yet. So if I seem a little distracted, it's just me being self-conscious. So anyway, Mrs. Darks sent me a letter. Well, she sent me a private message on our forums, which, as I tell you every week, is the best way to get in touch with me. And here's what she had to write. I'm just going to read a portion of this because I find this awesome. She says, "As it has finally been pointed out to me by our friend Pete of Me Like Trivia fame, so glad you liked the first episode. I can listen to podcasts over my phone at work. I've only had a smartphone for like 2 years before figuring this out. I'm a scientist, not an engineer, damn it. Anyway, I'm in a cycle of doing micro-injections at work, which is not nearly as cool as it sounds." Really? Are you sure? All right, anyway, she continues, parenthetically. "Essentially, I'm taking a microscopic glass needle and injecting foreign DNA into barely macroscopic roundworms and trying to make them glow under fluorescent light. Not that you'd care what I do at work." Wait a minute. That doesn't sound fascinating. I'm sure when you're actually doing it for hours a day, it's boring. But man, that sounds fascinating as all hell. You're making stuff glow. That's awesome. Anyway, she says, "I ramble in emails. Science! They are pretty mind-numbing to do, so I've been listening to Nerd Pride Radio while doing it. I've been going from most recent back, episode 51 at the moment, which is probably the wrong way to do it. Maybe I'll go back to the beginning, skipping the ones that Darks played for me so I didn't murder the instructors on my workout video DVD. Ack rambling. Sorry. I also, okay, that, you're getting the gist of this. That's really cool. All right. First off, she is a scientist. who is doing cool genetic experiments with glowy roundworms. And also, I love the whole rambly style. This is the whole clearly stream of consciousness. We get a glimpse at how her mind works. All I can say is, nerd, you are so welcome here. I'm so glad you're listening. It makes me so happy. Anyway, she gives me some compliments, and she sends me a bunch of Podomatic questions, which I am thrilled to death about. And anyway, it was just nice to hear from her. But after that, I have updates. My weight's up, my weight's down. Essentially, I don't remember exactly where I was last time I reported. I don't even remember the last time I did report, probably about a week ago. And I think I'm about the same as I was last week. So 256-ish this morning. So I don't think I've changed much, but it doesn't matter. I'm doing relatively well. A little good, a little bad. Yeah, things happen. But you know what's hard on a diet? Your family gatherings. Oh, that's the killer. We went camping this week with the whole family, and geez, it was bad enough teaching myself that I don't have to have a cigarette every time the whole family gets together. Just because everyone else is smoking, I don't have to smoke, and I finally have stopped. I've been able to, for a while now, not smoke while everyone else is doing it. That was the hardest part, that you're all sitting around the campfire, everyone has a couple of beers, you get relaxed, and you're like, oh, well, you know, it's just here. Sure, I haven't smoked in the last 2 years, but hey, it's campfire, I can smoke, right? And then you wind up being hooked on it for the next 3 or 4 weeks until you can finally break yourself again. It's terrible. Terrible. So finally I've gotten over that, but I can't stop myself from shoving every bit of food I find into my face, because every family gathering, you're just surrounded by it. The way, at least the way my wife's family all gets together, everybody brings something. You can't go to the campfire without everyone having a snack to pass around, whether it's sunflower seeds or a big bag of pistachio nuts. Ooh, go crazy for that. Or someone will bring out brownies or cookies or beef jerky or something. And so we're all just sitting around. This doesn't even include mealtimes. This is just us sitting around doing nothing. Everyone's always got something that they just pass around the circle. Everyone takes a little bit as it goes by until it's all out. And then a half hour later, somebody will bring something else out. Just nonstop food. For some reason, I can't say no to that stuff. It just, and I wish I could. I would love to be, I mean, you know, and you always make the same old excuses. Oh, it's a special occasion. Oh, come on, it's just one weekend. But it kills me every time, and I come back feeling bloated, and I feel miserable. My body's not used to that much fat and sugar and everything else, and it just, you feel so dragged down. But maybe one day I'll get over that. Anyway, either way, I broke even for the week, so I'm not going to complain a whole lot. But I also have, also under updates, I got to talking to Yancey about old fat actors, which I mentioned on a previous podcast, and he brought it up. This was just pure serendipity that I had talked about it on the podcast, and then he, by coincidence, also brings it up himself. And he said, you know what would be really cool for a buddy cop movie? And I said, no, tell me what. He says, Brendan Fraser and Nathan Fillion as partners in a buddy cop movie. And I said, oh my God, yeah. Because they have a very similar comedy persona. And especially they were both really super hunky in their youth, and now they've aged, and in my opinion, you know, Fillion's aged a little more gracefully than Fraser has, but they're both obviously older now, and I'm like, wow, that would be a great buddy cop film. And I said, but I'd really like to do it the way they did it in Running Scared, where you don't have to have them butting heads with each other at the beginning. You don't have to have them being enemy, you know, Lethal Weapon style, the whole, oh, they certainly don't get along. Oh, look at it. But then by the end, they bond and they become best of friends. No, go with the Running Scared style, where they're best friends right from the beginning. And that never wavers. You know, that's just who they are. And if you haven't seen Running Scared, oh, I highly recommend. It's a really old movie, and the plot is unbelievably stereotypical. It could be any episode of Law and Order. It could be, there's been a million films like it in that sense. But the two main characters are Gregory Hines and Billy Crystal, which does not seem like an action movie pair to me either. And yet they pull off this movie really well, and they pull it off because of that magic between the two of them. They just had chemistry, and it was, you felt right from the beginning that they had each other's back all the time. And it was really cool. And their banter was really good, and their action and their teamwork. And it was just fun. And I think a Philly and Fraser team up like that, maybe it doesn't even have to be a buddy cop film, but something else where they are partners or buddies in that sense, that working partners who just have a long history of they rely on each other and they trust each other implicitly. And that's not even in question. And now move on with the movie. I think that'd be a lot of fun. So anyway, good idea, Yancey. I was right on top of that with him. That was great. And that brings me to the Unnamed History segment.
Don't know much about history.
You know what baffles me? Cricket. You know, I'm listening to the Me Like Trivia podcast. I just listened. It was episode 2. And by the way, spectacular again. I'm still loving this podcast. Highly recommend. Go support Me Like Trivia. It's a great podcast. So I'm listening to it, and Pat mentions his vast knowledge of cricket. And I couldn't tell if he was bluffing or not, but he did mention that he even knows of the great cricket scandal of 1917 and blah, 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 blah. And it was, I'm like, I don't know about the great – what kind of scandal could cricket possibly have? And so I decided to do a little bit of research. And it turns out that you can find many places that have the top 10 or top 11 or top 12 greatest scandals in cricket history. And every one of these lists I look at had maybe two items in common, and then they all had completely different choices on them. So from what I can gather, cricket in its, you know – centuries-long history has probably had, I don't know, by this count, if this is a fair sampling, thousands of scandals. Holy crap, or at least a few dozen, because everyone picks out a different top 10. And they were fascinating, absolutely fascinating. If you want to talk about history, this was really cool stuff. Do you want them in chronological order, or just, because I've just got my notes jotted down at random here, but you know what? Let's start right at the beginning. I'll take them chronologically, even though, no, you know what? Because they're not as interesting that way. Because really, the most recent one is the Pakistan spot-fixing scandal. And this is, there are a bunch of these. This is, Pakistan just came up on a bunch of lists because it's the most recent one. And, hold on. I need a little drink of cool, refreshing diet Dr. Pepper. Just a second. If I knew where my pause button was, I would have stopped it for that. But there were a bunch of these where they had match-fixing scandals, spot-fixing scandal, bookkeeping scandals, all sorts of stuff having to do with gambling, essentially. And Pakistan's most recent one, three players just had weird innings that they did really unusual stuff. Like, just really, I can't even remember the details of it. And it turns out that they weren't trying to fix the match. They were just trying to fix particular plays. Because apparently in cricket betting, you can bet on, will this specific combination of events happen within the game? And if so, you can win. And so they made those things happen for money. And a big scandal. But that's not interesting. You get, you know, gambling scandals all the time in sports. That could be any sport. I wanted stuff that was uniquely cricket. And so I'm going to save that one for the end because that's my favorite, actually. One, there's a YouTube video called The Most Shameful Moment in Cricket History. And this one turned up on a couple of the lists as well. And I actually got to see it in play. And when you watch it, it culminates. It's Australia versus New Zealand. And it culminates in the Australian bowler rolling the ball out to the batsman and rolling it out underhanded. I mean, like literally an underhanded pitch to get it there. And so the ball just rolls across the ground. The batsman swats at it. And then throws his bat down and storms off in disgust. And the whole crowd goes nuts. And the announcers are going crazy going, oh my God, can you believe it? And I still don't get it. I do now because I looked it all up and I researched what the hell all that meant. But I mean, to me, it was, you know, I'm watching a complicated sport that I don't quite understand or don't understand at all. And that's fine. But I understand it's a sport going on and everyone's really into it and the announcers have an appropriate fervor to go with it. And then suddenly, wait, I think he's calling for an underhand bowl. He is. He's calling for an underhand bowl. Oh my. And then he throws out the underhand bowl and then everything's in panic. And that's the most shameful moment in cricket history, which I don't think it is the most shameful moment in cricket history. I'm going to bet some of the later ones about racism and apartheid are more shameful, but Be that as it may, I'm not a cricket aficionado. What do I know? But it turns out that this was the very end of a test match between Australia and New Zealand. And at this point, New Zealand is 6 points down. It's an incredibly close game. In a game that can last 5 days and have literally hundreds of runs scored, to get down to the very end of the game and there's only a 6-run difference, that's phenomenal. That's a nail biter. All right, so everyone's on the edge of their seat for this. Diet Dr. Pepper. And to get 6 points, I mean, like I say, he needs to get 6 points on this swing of the bat, apparently. And so the bowler chooses an underhand bowl, which is going to just roll it across the ground. Well, when you roll it across the ground, you can't get 6 points. To get 6 points, you need to literally bat the thing completely off the pitch into the stands. So you have to go outside the normal boundaries and then outside the pitch itself and into the stands. And when that happens, it's like a home run in American baseball. It just counts as an automatic 4 runs in American baseball. In cricket, you hit it out into the stands, it's an automatic 6 points. And so it was a long shot, but this was New Zealand's only chance to tie this game. They couldn't win, but they could at least tie it. And instead, the guy throws a pitch that ensures that there's no way that he can get 6 points. Well, why is that scandalous? That seems like a really smart move to me, doesn't it to you? That if I know that they need 6 points to tie, and I know that I can throw a pitch that will guarantee that he can't get 6 points, why would I not do that? Ah, well, it turns out, here's the scandal, that in New Zealand is playing by the English cricket rules, and in their rule book, it says that no bowler may bowl underhanded under any circumstances, period. So to them, this was just an illegal move in general. But Australians pull out the rule book, and sure enough, at the end of this video, the announcer has the rule book out and in front of a camera and showing us the circled spot where in the Australian rules, in the English rules that New Zealand was playing by, it's banned. In Australian rules, they didn't put that part in. So under Australian rules cricket, it was perfectly legal. And therefore, everyone thought that it was a cheap move and that essentially the Australians won by underhanded means. It's a toss-up for me. Again, I'm not passionate about cricket, so I don't understand the heat and the fervor, but I thought it was fascinating. And let's see, other ones? I mentioned the South African apartheid. In 1970, back in the 60s and in the 70s, black players couldn't play on the South African national team because, you know, racism. And so therefore, one of their best players, who in the article I read, it says he was technically considered black. So I'm guessing he was mostly white or he was half and half or whatever. But anyway, it says he's technically considered black and therefore he was not allowed to play on the South African team. But he was a spectacular player, so he moved to England. He plays with England. Awesome. Well, then it comes up to England is going to do a tour of South Africa and play against the South African teams. And when they choose the national team that's going to go to South Africa, they leave this dude out. Even though he's clearly one of their best players, they leave him out. And everyone assumes that it's due to, buckling to South African pressure that basically, oh, look, because we don't want to disturb their racism, we're not going to create a fuss, and therefore we're going to leave this dude out. And it was a huge scandal, and everyone was all in an uproar, apparently. And then it turns out that one of the other players on the team got injured before they even left. And so they put this dude back in, even though he's technically black and they're going to South Africa. They put this dude back in. And it turns out their fears were completely founded because they got to South Africa and South Africa said, no, we're not playing if you've got a black guy on your team. Not going to happen. Or specifically, not just a black guy. I don't know if they had a problem with all black guys on foreign teams because, how do they play Zimbabwe otherwise? But they said, not him. Because he's an expatriate. He's a South African that we wouldn't allow to play on our team. We're not going to let him play against us either. And so South Africa absolutely refused the tour. The English had to go home. They were done. And as a result of this, South Africa was banned from international cricket for as long as they had apartheid, 21 years. They were not allowed to back into cricket until finally Nelson Mandela takes over, apartheid ends, and in 1991, welcome back, South Africa, as part of the international cricket community once more. Fascinating. The earliest scandal, the veriest earliest one I could find. This one was great. Back in the 1800s, in cricket, there were two types of players. You had gentlemen, and then you had players. The gentlemen were nobles or wealthy individuals who were considered amateurs. You can't see the air quotes, but they're there. They were amateurs who just played cricket for the love of the game. They asked for no compensation. They just enjoyed being there because they loved the sport so much. As opposed to them were the crude and grubby working class players who played for money because, well, they're working class, and if they're going to devote their time to cricket, then they need to make a little cash off of it to support themselves. And the amateurs, the gentlemen, were considered far superior by nature of their breeding and birth. And they wound up, the gentlemen, wound up getting really nice locker rooms, lots of lavish luxuries that go with it to keep them happy while they're there. They get this wonderful food served. They get spacious accommodations and fancy transportation to and from events. And there's a lot of money being spent on these amateur unpaid players and unpaid amateurs. And what wound up happening is they started seeing, getting into the 1860s and 1870s, it got to the point where a lot of these so-called amateurs, these so-called gentlemen, were demanding more and more concessions that essentially worked out to they were getting paid to be there, and they were getting paid in all of these bonus things. They were getting paid a lot more than the players were when supposedly they were amateurs, and that's why they were there, was for the love of the game, but they're only doing it when they get these huge accommodations for them. And it led to such outrage that the players, the professional players, went on strike in 1881 and said, we have had enough of it. This is crap. We're not doing it anymore. And it didn't change anything at that moment, but it took a few more years, and eventually they stopped the distinction, and eventually it got to the point where, look, you're all just cricket players. There's no difference between professional and amateur anymore. You all get paid the same. You all get the same accommodations. But it was a huge scandal at the time because it was a whole class warfare thing right around the time of the Industrial Revolution. It was tough. Cricket can have this because cricket's been around longer than American baseball, longer than American football, certainly longer than basketball. Well, basketball is just a baby compared to these guys. So cricket has a very long and complicated history. And again, I could not stop reading this stuff. I went through article after article. The last one that I'm going to mention, and this one's my favorite. In 1932, Australian cricket, their team, was dominated by a dude named Don Bradman. And this guy was a batsman like no other. He was huge, and he could knock it out of the park every time, and he was unstoppable. And as a result, Australia won everything. And so in 1932, we've got Australia going up against England, and England decides they've got a new strategy for how to deal with Don Bradman. Their strategy is, normally when the bowler pitches or bowls the ball to the batsman, it bounces once and then it comes up low. So it's almost always coming up at the guy's feet or shins because you're aiming for the little wicket behind the batsman. I'll get to that in a minute. And so therefore you usually bat almost like a golf swing because you're going low every time. So what they decided to do was, you know what, We're going to go aggressive. You bounce it early, so therefore you've got a 90-mile-an-hour pitch going high, coming up at the aiming straight for the dude's chest or face, if at all possible. You are aiming for his body. You want it to go nice and high because when a cricket batsman defends against a pitch like that, he winds up batting it short, and so they could just play a bunch of close fielders, and then he would wind up defending himself every time, so most of the shots at Don Bradman, he winds up having to go for these high blocks, and they wind up getting them out really easy, or at least a lot easier than they did before. And as a result, they kept the effect of Don Bradman to a minimum for a long time. And it wound up being a huge scandal because it was considered unsportsman, because you're aiming for the dude's face. You're aiming to hit a dude. And they used it not just on Don Bradman, but on a lot of people. And eventually there was a big uproar and people protested that it seemed like it was cheating, which, you know, it certainly did. And they wound up, and it wasn't breaking any rules. It wasn't cheating. Everything they did was completely fair. But as a result, they instituted some rule changes that made sure you couldn't do that. And then Don Bradman went back to dominating the entire sport until 1948, I think. I can't remember. He was around a long time. I'm guessing that he's an Australian cricket hero, that he's a name like Babe Ruth in America. I'm guessing, but I don't know for sure. I haven't asked any Australians. So as a result of all of this, that's the history portion of the history segment. As a result of all of this, I realized I don't know anything about cricket. And I'm guessing that cricket, if you're a cricket enthusiast in the United States, assuming you didn't come from England or Australia or New Zealand or South Africa or some other nation, India, where cricket is popular, assuming that you are an American citizen who is a United States citizen who is a cricket enthusiast, you're probably a nerd. You probably fit in really well here, because it's the sort of thing that you have to actively decide at some point that you're going to pursue this, that you really want to be interested in cricket, and let's go after it. Because the thing is crazy, or at least it seems crazy at first, because I went out and I started off straight away with a search for Cricket for Dummies, because it's got to be out there, right? Sure enough, I find Cricket for Dummies, and the very first thing on the page is it's a diagram of the field or pitch. And well, no, I think the pitch is just the center portion. Anyway, it's a diagram of the entire field, and it shows all of the fielding positions available in cricket. And as I'm looking at it, okay, there's the pitch in the middle. Yeah, the pitch is the middle stripe. So there's the pitch in the middle where the batsman and the bowler stand and do their business. And then there's all these fielding positions on this giant oval around it. And the fielding positions, I'm looking at this diagram, there's like 30 fielding positions. And in the diagram, they all have names. I'm going to read them off from the diagram directly here. Let's see. There's the cover and the extra cover. All right. So far, I can get that. A point. Okay. Silly point. Seriously? Silly? The gully. The forward short leg. The wicket keeper. Okay. I can get wicket keeper. That makes sense. Like a goalkeeper. Sure. But then there's the deep square leg. And then the fine leg. There's a second slip. There's a third man. Did I mention the gully? Gully? As a position. All right. So my first thought is someone is completely pulling my chain here. This is crazy. There's no way there are 30 positions on a cricket field and that they all have these names. This is clearly something that came out of Mad Magazine where they wanted to pull something over on people. They want, this is a joke. Obviously. And no, turns out it's not. No. There's 30 positions out here, and they all have really, really stupid names, which I'm sure makes sense to the people who are playing it. And by the way, if you look at this diagram, the positions are not in any sort of order. There's no obvious, you know, like if you've got, you know, a line of four possible positions on the left side, it matches up to the same line of four. No, it's like they're in big sweeping curves, like a big wave of positions that could possibly be anywhere. And it turns out that, yes, there's 30 available positions, but you only generally have, I think, 11 men on the field at a time, and then a 12th as a spare, or 10 and an 11th as a spare, something like that. There's only 10 or 11 men playing on the field at any one time. But a good captain has to account for, okay, here's the batters that we have available. Therefore, okay, when this batter is up, I need you in this position, you in this position, you in this position, because that's how we have to field against this dude. Okay, now, everyone switch up. So that way you can just call out that, okay, I want you on short leg. I want you on cover. I need someone at first slip and second slip, because we think that, you know, whatever. So you've got 30 possible positions, but you don't have someone at every position all the time. I keep thinking it's like baseball where we have these set, you know, obviously your first base, your shortstop, your left field. It's not like that. All right. So that starts to make a little bit more sense. And then I finally found an article written by a woman who I think she said she was from the Bahamas. I can't remember. But she wrote up a very simple explanation of cricket for complete novices like myself. And so based on that, I finally figured out how cricket is played, or at least I have a really rudimentary understanding of it. And if I get any of this wrong, hey, what do I know? I'm American. But you've got this giant oval field, and in the center of that field is the pitch. It's your stripe that you can imagine that this is the pitch is like, you know, from your pitcher's mound to a batter's box in American baseball. Except that you have the pitcher stands at one end, and then there's a batsman at the other end, and then there's also a batsman behind him, but I'll get to that in just a minute. So the pitch bowler. The bowler pitches the ball down to the batsman, and the batsman tries to hit it. If he gets a hit, if he knocks it out, then he tries to make a run to the other end of the pitch. There's a batting box on either end of the pitch, and he just has to run down to the other end of the pitch. And so if the two batsmen, like I say, there's one at each end, if the two batsmen can swap positions and both get safe to the other end, that counts as a run. All right, and so however many times they can run back and forth, that counts as a run. And so when you wind up after you score a run, well, now you've switched batsmen. Now you're standing behind the bowler, and you've got your partner batsman is standing at the other end, now waiting for another pitch. And a batsman will stay on the field until he gets out. That's rough. That can be really long. They say a good batsman can, you know, what you're hoping for is to get 50 runs while you're up at bat. But, you know, a really good one can get 100, 150. They said, I think the record was like 400 and something in a single at bat. Holy crap. And it's probably not called at bat. I get that. But anyway, that's the basics of the game. And then to get the guy out is, I think, if you tag him with the ball, if you can, if the ball can knock, because behind each batter, there are the wickets. It's just three pegs in the ground, and the pegs have, little boards set on top of them, the bales. And if you can knock the top part off of the peg, then that's an out. And you have to do it with the ball. So the pitcher, when he's pitching, is aiming for the wicket. He's aiming to knock that thing over so he can get the guy out immediately. If a fielder gets it, a fielder can run over holding the ball and knock over a wicket. And so when you, all right, I just lost my train of thought, darn it. Oh. So anyway, when a batsman gets out, then, all right, he's out for this inning, and then another batsman comes in for him. So his partner stays there, and then the new batsman comes in. And then eventually, when all of your players are out, you're done, and now it's the next guy's turn. That's an inning. And you play, each team gets two innings in a test match. A test match has, I believe, a maximum of 5 7-hour days to play a single test match. So the runs can get up into enormous scores based on this. All of that seems really alien to me, but the rules are pretty basic. I mean, there's other ways of getting people out, and there's other details of the rules, and there's all sorts of things where you can substitute people in or where you can run doing that. Who knows? But the basics of it is you just got a strip of grass in the middle of the field, and he rolls the ball to you, well, bounces the ball to you. If you can hit the ball, you just run back and forth scoring runs. And if one of these conditions is met, you're out, another dude takes over. And when all your guys are out, your side's done. That's it. I mean, it makes enough sense that I feel like I could actually watch a little cricket. I'm not gonna, but I could. And by the way, statistics say that there's about 30,000 people in the United States of America who actually watch cricket recreationally at least once a year. 30,000. I would have expected the number to be a little bit better than that. I mean, ESPN2 has to have cricket on every once in a while. Somebody's got to be catching that in the middle of the night just because there's nothing better going, and just watch for a little while going, damn, what the hell are they doing? All right. Somebody. But 30,000 is the number. So that is the full extent of my knowledge of cricket. I am absolutely done. I've seen cricket played one time, live, and that was when we were, where were we stationed? I can't remember. I think it was in Alabama, maybe. So I was maybe 10. And we wound up going over to a colonel's house or a general's house for some garden party thing. And he apparently had been stationed in England. And while he was in England, that was where his daughters were born. And he had been there forever. And so he moves back to the States now. He's an Air Force colonel or general or whatever he was. And so his two daughters, U.S. citizens, born to their American Air Force father, but grew up their entire lives in England. Therefore, they both had British accents. They were around my age, maybe a little older. But they both had British accents, and they loved cricket. And so they got out there, and they said, hey, we should play some cricket. And I can't even remember if I participated or if it was just – but they had a bunch of people out there, and they were playing some cricket. And it didn't make any sense to me then either, but it was fascinating. I mean, weird. Because I kept trying to compare it to baseball. You're in your gut. You just want to compare it to baseball. How many times during this description did I make baseball analogies to try and make sense of this stuff? And it just doesn't line up. I mean, you can see where they had a common ancestor at one time, but just not quite cricket. You know what I mean? Anyway, enough of that. If I had my show notes in front of me, I'd be moving on to the next segment, which is, oh, it's time to visit my gaming table.
I've got Dungeon Master's Guide. I've got 12-sided die.
Role-playing games, video games, card games, if it fits on my gaming table, I am here to share it with you. And here's what I have today. Go to Paizo. Go to paizo.com and look off to the right side of the screen, and there is a logo for the Great Golem Sale 2014. And I say Golem, not Golem, but that's my choice. And you click on the Great Golem Sale, whatever it's called. And go buy some cheap game stuff. They have games and accessories and stuff from a bunch of different companies, but most of it is Paizo stuff. And of the Paizo stuff, I went nuts on the Pathfinder stuff, obviously, because you know how much I love Pathfinder. I went in there, and for Pathfinder, I bought adventure modules for $1. 32-page adventure modules for $1. Oh, and then shipping kind of turns that buck into $2, but even $2 is a deal and a half. I wound up buying 18 books, and I don't know when I'll actually get them because they're being shipped to school where my wife works, and then she will hide them from me and she'll dole them out as gifts at some point. I don't care. That's fine. I need to get a couple of them right away because I want to have a couple of them to use, but then the others, there's a bunch of adventures. I got a bunch of adventures. I got a few campaign accessories, things like stuff on gods and the outer planes and things like that. And I also picked up, because right now you guys know I'm playing in a Rise of the Rune Lords campaign. It's an adventure path from Paizo. Paizo does adventure paths where it's always 6 books, and the first book is starting you off at first level and taking you through up to about 4th level. And then second book picks right where that one left off, and they're all interconnected adventures that all lead to some grand, I imagine, world-altering event. I don't know. I guess you get to save the world by the end. I've never actually read the final book, so I don't know how they finally wind up. I don't know how grand scale they are, but by the end, you're going to be 20th level. So it's this whole arc taking you from zero to hero on this huge adventure path. And my brother told me about the Golem Sale. He said, get over there and start buying some stuff. He said, here's what you do. He said, go look at the adventure paths, and then just pick up, find one or two that you like, and just pick up the first 3 books. He says, because you never play a campaign past 10th or 11th level anyway, so don't bother to buy the extra books unless for some reason you play them all and your kids are really, really excited, and then you don't mind paying full price for them at that point. He said, go buy the first 3 books. And so I did that. I picked one of the adventure paths. I can't remember which one, but it was one that looked, that had all 6 books available, and of that, it was the one that looked most fascinating. And so I got myself half of an adventure arc. I got, maybe 6 modules that looked awesome. I got some, anyway, I got tons of stuff. So get over to paizo.com. I assume the sale is still going on. Several people from the site, I made a recommendation on the website, and several people there have gone in. But if you're into role-playing games at all, I mean, seriously, books for $1 or $2 a piece? You can't go wrong. I think the Adventure Path books are like $5, and the campaign books I got are $3.50. Totally worth my time. I am so, so happy about this. Like I say, I got like 18 books, and then after the shipping, I paid maybe $3.50, $4 a piece for them on average. You can't beat that. This is a good, good deal. And like I say, it'll keep my wife in gifts for me for years to come. So I'm very, very happy about that. Let's see, what else is next? Ooh, now it's time for a nerd culture report.
I thought this was bowling for weirdos.
No, Gonzo, but you are very, very close. In honor of episode 2 of the Me Like Trivia podcast, These are some trivia tidbits that have been banging around on my master list. They've been begging to be put into the podcast, but they're tiny. And so therefore, I don't have a big place for them. And I'll start off with the first one is actually the recent one because I was inspired by the Me Like Trivia podcast. They mentioned the sequel to the song A Boy Named Sue. And I was able to provide them with some details that hopefully, episode 2.5, hopefully they'll mention some of that same stuff. But the song A Boy Named Sue by Johnny Cash, the song is iconic. And the thing that I found interesting about it, and I think I got this from the Daily Knowledge podcast from todayifoundout.com, I think. I can't remember where it came from. It might have been from a bathroom reader. It's, anyway, acquired knowledge from years of bumping around stupid trivia stuff. And when Johnny Cash first performed that song, he got it from Shel Silverstein, the famed children's poet who was also an artist and poet and musician in all sorts of fields, but he's most famous for his children's books. And he got this song, A Boy Named Sue, from Shel Silverstein, and Johnny Cash loved it, absolutely loved it, and he wanted to perform it at his Folsom Prison concert. This very famous Live from Folsom Prison album was recorded there, and that's where A Boy Named Sue first appeared, and Cash was so enamored of this song that he had to perform it, but he didn't have time to rehearse it enough. He hadn't learned the lyrics. I mean, he knew he loved the song, but he hadn't had time to learn all the lyrics. So what you're hearing, if you listen to that original live recording from Folsom Prison, what you're hearing is him holding the song lyrics in his hand as he's up there with his guitar and his microphone. He's got the song lyrics in his hand, and as he's singing, he's reading them off the paper because he doesn't know the lyrics yet. And if the song sounds a little rough and you can hear some weird spots in it, well, that's why. The guy was just totally winging it. And yet, friggin' classic. Everybody knew that song. And I don't know about you, I loved that song when I was a kid. And I still know all the lyrics to it, and I will still rock to it if it comes up because I love Johnny Cash in general. So, just fascinating. That was my first bit of trivia. But also to go with it, the sequel involved the father's side, because the whole song A Boy Named Sue is Sue himself complaining about this horrible bastard father of his and how he had to hunt him down and blah, blah, blah. And then finally they made peace. And the sequel is from his dad's point of view and makes him out to be a transgender and or transvestite. I was going to say transgendered person, but he made him out to be a transvestite. I said he was wearing a dress and he was a screaming queen and all of this stuff. The sequel is dirty, and I don't even know if it's been professionally recorded and released somewhere, but I've read the lyrics to it. Filthy, filthy song. Really funny. Also by Shel Silverstein. But that leads me right into trivia point number two. Hey, speaking of transgendered stuff, did you know Yoshi's a dude? All right, and I've always just assumed Yoshi's a dude, right? You have too, I assume. I mean, Yoshi the dinosaur from Mario, he's a dude, right? I've just always assumed he was. He's a dude that lays eggs, but he's still a dude. And I can't remember where my son pointed this out to me, but he says right here, no, look, in the official literature, he's described as a he. They use a masculine pronoun for him, even though he lays eggs. So apparently he's a kind of that, and it just baffled me that until he pointed it out, he said, did you realize Yoshi's a dude? And I said, well, I assumed he was. And then my son goes, yeah, he's a dude that lays eggs. I'm like, how did I miss that? How did that never strike me as odd that he's a dude that lays eggs? Anyway, speaking of eggs, that leads me to trivia point number three, specifically eggs from dudes. If you have an egg laid by a rooster, so an egg laid by a male chicken, it is called a cock egg. Yeah, a cock egg. And how do you know it's a cock egg? Because when you candle it, when you hold it up to the light, there's no yolk in it. It is an eggshell completely filled with egg whites. Bizarre. All right. And it was believed that any cock egg, an egg without a yolk in it, was laid by the rooster. And they believed that cock eggs were where the mythical beast, the cockatrice, came from. And so therefore, if you wanted to prevent a cockatrice from hatching from your cock egg, then you had to throw the egg over your house so that it lands in the opposite yard and breaks on the ground without ever touching the house itself. If you could do that, and you could prevent cockatrice from apparently invading and taking over your chicken yard. Turns out that, as far as I can tell, roosters don't actually lay eggs. And what the science is saying is that no, it's not roosters laying eggs. The real source of the cock eggs is actually from usually from first year chickens, first year layers that the females, their reproductive, gear is just not quite fully developed yet. And so they'll lay basically the cock egg is like a practice egg. It's like a first try before the mechanism is completely ready. And so you wind up with a cock egg, a yolkless egg. And they say a very, very occasionally something will go wrong in a fully adult hen, and she'll wind up laying a yolkless egg. But that is really, really rare. They said usually it's just from an immature chicken, an immature hen who wasn't quite ready yet, but she produces an egg as her starter trial. So there you go. But let's see. Speaking of unlikely methods of reproduction, that leads me to trivia number four. Resurrection plants. This was another one from Yancey. Resurrection plants are just fascinating. The story he tells is fantastical and amazing. And I look it up, and it is generally pretty true. A resurrection plant, he called it a Lazarus plant because that's how it was described on whatever radio show or podcast he was listening to. But the term that I found online was resurrection plants. And there's a bunch of different ones from all over the world. What happens to them is during dry weather, the plant will completely dry up, completely desiccate, loses all of its water, and becomes essentially a tumbleweed. But the tumbleweed with its seeds still at the center and protected by the harder outer dried up shell. And then these tumbleweeds will blow across the landscape until they find water. And then once they get hit with moisture, they unfold, blossom out, and they turn green again. And if they get enough moisture, then the seeds will wind up hatching out and plant and start growing. Holy crap. And such a seed can lay dormant, lay dried up for years, unbelievably long years. The North American version of this, let's see, Salaginella or Salaginella lepidophila. Something like that. Anyway, it's known as the Rose of Jericho, or actually there's also another plant that I believe is from the Mideast that's also known as the Rose of Jericho. So the American one is sometimes called the False Rose of Jericho, or it has half a dozen other names. But these are plants that rely on potentially rolling around for years, maybe even decades. I think they were talking about an example of one that prehistoric, that this thing had been found lodged, trapped, buried somewhere, that it had been dried up and laying dormant for literally thousands of years. They got it wet, sucker blooms out, seeds grow, the whole business. And that just fascinates me. Absolutely fascinating. I mean, what sort of, you know, because when you start picturing this, you're like, what kind of odd bit of evolution creates a situation where, you know, you're just, you know, okay, the rain stops. You're in a desert environment where it rains maybe once every 5 years, you know, sometimes. That now in the Americas, it usually happens in places where you have one rainy season a year. So when your plant dries up, starts blowing around, you usually have to wait 1 year for a good rain. But in some cases here, and especially in the Mideast, there's places where you don't get rain for years at a time. You could be blowing around for literally decades, just waiting for, oh, hey, ran into some water. Time to open up. Time to plant some seeds. Better hurry up and grow because we've only got about 2 weeks before everything dries up again. Okay, let's go dormant. That's just crazy, just absolutely crazy. But I kept reading on these, and they were just endlessly fascinating. But speaking of lousy segues, that brings me right to my fifth trivia point, and my last one, actually. I was listening to an interview with Mike Myers, the comic actor Mike Myers, the guy from Shrek and Saturday Night Live and all of that, not the guy in the Will Shatner mask terrorizing people on Halloween. Mike Myers, the comic actor, the Canadian, in his interview, he's talking about how he came up and who he's worked with and where he's been. And I'm not going to recount all this. If you want to go pull up the Mark Maron WTF podcast and you want to listen to the whole interview, it's out there. And it's really fascinating. He was a really, although one of the things that intrigued me about him is as I'm listening to Mike Myers in an interview, after an hour and a half, I was fascinated. I thought it was great. I really enjoyed hearing his story. It was entertaining and informative. And by the end of it, I also realized that, you know what? As much as I love Mike Myers and I love all the stuff he's done, I bet I wouldn't get along with him really well in real life. It just sounds, it's just something about it that, yeah, I bet him and I would clash a little bit. I mean, not that I'm going to have that chance, but if I did, yeah, he just seems a little, I don't know, high-strung, a little, I don't know. I couldn't quite put my finger on it, but there was something definitely a little off-putting for me personally. But again, I still love him. I still love his work, and I still love everything that he does, except for, I Married an Axe Murderer wasn't all that great, and The Cat in the Hat was really kind of weak. Okay, so he's hit or miss, but I have great respect for his comedy. And anyway, coming up, Mike Myers was in Second City, the Canadian improv group that produced people like John Candy and them. He was in Second City because he was Canadian. He was in Second City in Chicago and in Toronto, and he was connected to a bunch of those really famous players that came out of Second City. Also being Canadian, he was with the Kids in the Hall. He was almost a Kids in the Hall member. They asked him. And I heard another interview with a different member of Kids in the Hall who had said the exact same thing. They said, oh, yeah, we had Mike Myers working with us at the time. And, he would join us a lot. But it just didn't work out. And he moved on to other things. And he never really was a full cast member. But, you know, there was that possibility. Sure. So okay. Second City, Kids in the Hall. Obviously Saturday Night Live, because that's where he became renowned. That's where he gained his real fame in the comedy business, at least in the United States. So Second City, Kids in the Hall, Saturday Night Live. And then he said, oh, yeah, when he was younger, he worked in London for a while before Saturday Night Live. And while he was in London, at the Comedy Store in London, he helped found the Comedy Store Players. To which I say, the who? I've never heard of the Comedy Store Players. But you start naming off some of the people who were in the Comedy Store Players, and some of them still are, in fact. Josie Lawrence, Richard Franch, Paul Merton, Jim Sweeney. None of those names sound familiar to you, do they? Well, they do to me, and they do to anybody who watched the original British version of Whose Line Is It Anyway from back in the 80s or early 90s. And, yeah, apparently Mike Myers helped found the Comedy Store Players. And the Comedy Store Players are the people who started Whose Line Is It Anyway. It was an improv troupe who played these games in their stage act and then eventually brought it to British television with Clive Anderson as their host and Ryan Stiles as probably the most regular player on that. And then Ryan Stiles, of course, brings it to America with Drew Carey. And you guys, if you haven't watched Whose Line Is It Anyway, I don't know what's wrong with you. I love the original Whose Line Is It Anyway, the British version. I love the original Drew Carey version, and I love the new Aisha Tyler version that's out right now. I can't get enough of this show. I am thoroughly entertained. I went and saw Colin and Brad live doing their own improv, an evening with Colin and Brad live right here in my little town. It was awesome, but I've told you about that before. So anyway, I was just amazed that Mike Myers is connected to that many really influential groups within the comedy world, and of those groups, just how many really famous people have come out of those groups, and how many of those famous people worked with him at the times he was there. He was just a charmed life, which that implies that there was a lot of luck to what he did. And from all accounts, everyone who knew him then said, no, they recognized that, yeah, Mike Myers was incredible. You knew the first time you saw him perform that, yeah, this kid was going somewhere. He had real, real talent. So anyway, just fascinating. So that's the end of my nerd culture report. I had 5 bits of trivia and really crappy segues, and I wanted to get all of them out, spew them all over you guys. So being done with the meticulously plotted portion of this podcast, there is nothing left but the Pod-O-Matic! Hot dog! This is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 and his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble, and he rolls up random topics for me to talk about. Where do these topics come from, you ask? Well, that is where you come in. You and Mrs. Darks and Lucy and my brother Kyle and Talvin and Stan and Zimny Humongous, Ronster, everybody who's contributed. I'm sure there's like five other names that I've forgotten who still have a bunch of entries on here. Anyway, doesn't matter. I'm getting distracted. This is where you come in. You want to hear me haver on about something? You send your question or to Darks himself, in addition to the lovely Mrs. Darks. You want to hear me haver on about something? Then you send your question or topic to me by email, or better yet, in a private message on our forums. I will add it to the Pod-O-Matic list. Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be. Thank you so much. You guys keep... they're just trickling in. I keep worrying that, oh God, if I don't get any more, I'm going to start running out. Like the last 6 weeks that I've been recording every week, the number available to me is hovering right around 140 or 150, which is just enough that I'm like, oh God, three good episodes. And maybe I won't have enough to fill up a whole list. That would suck. And so I always worry that I'm not going to get enough and I need to start begging. And you guys keep coming through. Like I say, just 4 at a time, 10 at a time, 1 at a time. I haven't had any of the super 100 long lists in a long time, but those don't have quite the quality of these short lists. You guys are clearly putting a lot of thought in these. I really appreciate them. I'm so glad to have them. Anyway, enough of that. The number is 46. And do I have my Pod-O-Matic list open? Oh my goodness, I do, and it's even randomized. How about that? Number 46 is from Ronster, speak of the devil. Well, I spoke of all of you, so there's a good chance I was going to hit one. Ronster says, of your ancestors, with whom would you have a one-hour conversation? Well, that is an amazing and bizarre question. Of my ancestors. All right. My gut reaction is to say, I want to have a conversation with Jump Jones. And not my nephew, Jump Jones, who, oh, I wish we could have called him Jump, but he doesn't like it. He likes to be called Jack. But Jack Jump Jones, that's his name. Jack Jump Jones. That is the greatest name ever. Anyway, he is named for a great, 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 great uncle of mine, Civil War dude. And I don't know how many greats are involved in that, but he's from the Civil War, and his name was Jump Jones, and because we didn't have DNA or fingerprints or any of the identifying information you needed you needed a description on paper so that after battle we could start matching bodies to the descriptions that were written down in your official file to try and identify you. And Jump Jones, his description in his official file, he was a Confederate soldier. His official description was, a 7-foot giant with flaming red hair. Period. Oh, man. Do you want to meet that guy? Does that not sound phenomenal? 7-foot tall giant with flaming red hair in a Confederate soldier's uniform. That's pretty cool. All right. But that's not who I really want to talk to. If I could have a 1-hour conversation with any of my ancestors, I would go back to my grandfather, my papa, my mom's dad, who died when I was 7, and died in our house, in our bathroom, in fact. And he was, by all accounts, a super cool guy. I loved him when he was alive. I have very, very fond memories of the time I spent with him. And he's a great, great dude. And now that he's gone, I'm older, and I've heard other stories about him and the things that he did with his life. And he was a musician. He was an artist. He had just a lot of interesting, fascinating stuff about him. He was a very soft-spoken, mellow sort of guy. And I think I would love to sit down and have a conversation with my papa. I really would. The guy was incredible, by all accounts, a hero. And I would love to have that chance. I would love to get to meet him as an adult and get to really talk to him about where he came from. It would be spectacular. I would love to do that. 08. 08 is from Humongous. Humongous says, Verde or red sauce? Yeah, okay, Verde being green. Do I like green sauce or do I like red sauce? I like red. I am an American, damn it. And therefore, I like ketchup, and I like marinara, and I like red salsa, and I'm done. That's it. There are no other sauces. Oh, except hollandaise. I love hollandaise. But when it comes to green versus red, I know. I've seen green sauces made with green tomatoes, or with the Mexican stuff made with tomatillos, or tomatillos, as I believe how they're pronounced. and those green sauces, I've tried them. They're my favorite Mexican restaurant, just down the road from my house here, serves a enchilada platter that is spectacular. I get three different enchiladas, each with a different filling and a different topping, and one of them has a verde, a green sauce, on top of it, made from tomatillos, and it's spectacular. I absolutely love it. But green sauce throws me every time. It just looks unnatural to me. I want to like it, and I do like it when I just forget that I'm eating green sauce and I just eat it and enjoy it. I like them just fine, but I would much prefer for my sauce to be red. It has nothing to do with flavor, nothing to do with taste. It's purely an aspect of color, and that's all it is. I would prefer a red sauce over a green sauce, just the way it goes. 85. Let's see, 85 at the bottom of my list is from, hey, Ronster. Ronster says, can you swim? Yes, I can. How did you learn? They threw me in a pool. Oh, hold on. Phone ringing. Just a second. Hi, this is Mike. I shouldn't have paused it. It was a wrong number. And a fascinating one. Oh, well. Anyway, where was I? I got to... Okay, I did red sauce versus green sauce. Did I roll again? Oh, I'm completely lost. Oh, can you swim? How did you learn? Yeah. I can swim. I can swim really well. I enjoy swimming. And apparently, I can never remember a time that I wasn't in a swimming pool. My earliest memories when I was 2 years old, I remember visiting my grandparents regularly in Houston, and my grandparents had a swimming pool in their backyard, and I loved being in that swimming pool, and they tell me that I swam pretty well from a very early age because I was just constantly in the water, and that when I was swimming, they said my one flaw is that I had no idea how to breathe while I was swimming, and so I would just, they'd put me in the water, and I would just swim and just go, and then they would have to tap me on the head and remind me to come up and take a breath. Okay, now, go back down and swim again. I love swimming. I've always loved swimming, and when I got older, I remember years and years of taking swimming lessons at the Y. At the YMCA, I would walk from my school down to the YMCA with my best friend Billy, and we would take our swimming lessons, and we had a great time doing that. And then my mom would come pick us up afterwards, and I love to swim. Yeah, swimming's great. I don't remember how I learned to swim. I've always been able to swim. And I learned how to swim properly from the YMCA, but even before that, I've been in the water forever. 09. Back to the top. 09 is from a Mr. Billy Bob. Billy Bob says, if you lived in Westeros, which of the seven would you worship? All right, you're assuming that I would worship the seven at all. But if that's my choice, all right, and I probably would, now that you bring it up. But if I worship the seven, well, they come as a matched set. So this is probably a trick question because the correct answer is, well, I'd worship all of them, obviously, because that's the way that religion is set up. You worship all of them. But which one would I venerate above the others? Who would be my patron of the seven? Let's see. There's mother, father, maid, stranger, I remember. The old woman, the hag, or whatever they called her, the old woman. I said maid already. A warrior, and who else? Hold on. Let's go look. I've got six of the seven. But Google's my friend. Westeros the seven. Here we go. Smith. It's the Smith. Never mind. Okay, so mother, father, crone was the right name. Maid, warrior, stranger, Smith. Okay, of those seven, I would probably venerate the father above the others just because I am a dad and it's a really important aspect of my life. But the one that's most attractive to me is the Smith. It's the whole dwarven aspect of my D&D playing. I love dwarves, always have, and something pulls me about that one, but probably father, but Smith is a good close second, good hardworking man. Nice. 01. Holy crow. We're right there. Number one is from Kyle. And Kyle said, what is worse, reading an awesome game system but never playing it, or playing an awesome game system as a player but never reading it. Oh, well, boy, neither one of those is unattractive to me. I would say never playing it. I have a tough time imagining playing in a game to which I don't have at least a good passing familiarity with the rules, where I haven't actually, gone in and at least bought them, looked them over a little bit. I can't imagine being in a game without knowing the rules, without having seen them. I mean, I understand that it happens, and I've certainly played with lots of people where, oh, don't worry about it. We'll keep you going. Here's your character sheet. Here's what the basics mean, but don't worry about that. Let's just play. I've done that to people before. I can see it happening. But then you would be playing in an awesome game and having an awesome time, and I don't care so much about rules anymore. They become less and less important to me as time goes on. But reading an awesome game system and then never playing it? Oh, that's heartbreaking. And I've done that plenty of times. I've got tons of games that I have phenomenal game concepts, great storytelling, almost mini plays that you're role playing out. Especially some of these Scandinavian games that have come out in the last decade or so. Just great concepts that I will never actually play. I own them. I have a lot of them on my hard drive. And I love looking at them. And then I realize that, if I ever have a chance to play any of these, most likely I'll wind up playing something like Paranoia or something that everyone's familiar with because, the chances I get to play games don't come around that often. And so, God, if I've got one chance to play something, do I want to risk it on something completely unknown? Or do I want to go with something that I know I already enjoy and I know I'll have a great time with? Do I want to spend my one chance at gaming? Do I want to spend that on something where we might have to fumble for the rules a little bit and that we don't really know what's going on? It's just tough. And so a lot of those have just sat by the wayside, and it's a little disappointing. But, yeah, that would be much worse. Much, much worse. Although, yeah, you know what? I've got to get off my butt. I've got a bunch of these games on my hard drive, and a few of them actually in print. I need to take up the role of game master again and sat down with the Roll20 group and just play a round of this. I mean, we're trying to do that with, I don't even know if we have a name for it yet, our advanced God's Dice version of the game that I've already talked about where we're going to play a Firefly style game. That's probably my first priority just because we've been wanting to play something like that for ages, and we've just never done it. But also, learning a lesson from Darks here, if I'm going to play something, I almost want to play something pre-written. I want to play some kind of module. I got a strong urge. I just recently re-listened to my own episode 30, way back, Murder Lake. And in episode 30, I talked about Pariah, the game that I wrote and published 12 years ago, and I realize how much I miss that game. I've only played it a few times. I would love to do that one on Roll20. And man, I should break that out. I really should. Anyway, okay, this is completely off topic. Is it worse to read an awesome game system but without playing it, or play an awesome game system without reading it? Much worse to read it and then never get a chance to try it. And that's something I need to rectify here soon. 92. Straight to the bottom. 92 from Humongous. Beer or wine? Oh, that is so easy. Beer. And I hate beer, by the way. But I hate wine even more. I don't know. My taste buds are off. I'm one of those guys who I can't eat cilantro because cilantro tastes like soap. I'm missing whatever it is. There's a taste receptor that recognizes cilantro. And if you have that taste receptor, cilantro is awesome. I am missing that. And so to me, cilantro tastes like eating soap. I mean, really, I've tried just a raw sprig of cilantro and I'm like, no, that is definitely soap. I can't stand the stuff. And so whatever my missing taste receptor is, it throws off the tastes of a lot of things for me. And wine is one of them. No matter how many times I have tried wine, no matter how many times I've tried good wines and bad wines and stuff people have recommended and oh no, you're going to love this. And everyone around the table thinks it's awesome. Wine to me tastes disgusting. Because I have some nitpicky stuff where I have problems with food textures and I have problems with food colors and I'm just weird and picky about my food in general. No, this is one that just wine, I mean, it's a liquid. I can drink grape juice, you know, so it's not a color issue. It's not a texture issue. It's just wine tastes like crap. I cannot drink it. I can choke it down if I have to, but oh, it's unpleasant. Beer, on the other hand, beer also tastes nasty to me, but not as nasty. And in college, because I was poor but wanted to party and get drunk with my friends, I learned to drink beer just because that was the cheapest way to go out and party with your friends. So I learned to drink beer, and I can tolerate beer, but I don't like beer either. Now that I have money, and I don't drink very often at all, but if I do drink, I'm going to have something I enjoy. You know what? I don't mind getting myself, you know, one of these fruity wine cooler type things, a Seagram's Grape or the Bartles and James strawberry daiquiri things that they bottle up. I enjoy those. I like a good fruity drink. I love whiskey. I'll drink whiskey and Coke or just straight whiskey. I have no problem with that. That is awesome to me. So if given my choice, I will not touch beer or wine, even if it's available and it's free. No, I'm not interested. If I want to have some alcohol, I have the money to buy something that I'm going to enjoy, and I don't enjoy either one of those things. But if I had to pick one of them because there's a gun to my head or you're going to kill my children, then okay, all right, I'll drink some beer. Jeez, whatever, just back off. 93 from Zimney. Zimney says, how many hours a day do you spend online? Oh, quite a few. Holy crap. Out of my 8-hour work day, I could be online. I mean, I'm always in front of a computer. That's the problem. I always have a computer going when I'm at work, whether it's a laptop while I'm out in the field, whether it's my desktop when I'm back in my office. There's always a computer going, and there's so many work programs that I have. They're all online applications now. So if I need to check my calls, if I need to, re-image a workstation, if I need to look up user information, if I need to do any of that, it's all online. So I'm online a lot. And then when I come home, well, I got to keep up with my website. I got to keep up with my podcast. I have to make an appearance at Facebook and Twitter just to make sure that I've checked in and I'm not missing anything. I've got to check my email on a regular basis. I'm online a lot. Hours a day at work. Let's say half of my workday involves doing something online. I mean, even when I'm actually hands-on physically repairing something or installing something, often it also involves going online to make sure all the settings are correct, going back to what I'm doing. So maybe half of my workday, and then depending on the evening, during the work week, weeknights, oh, maybe a half hour a night sometimes, but sometimes an hour or two if there's something going on. But usually, you know, we've got supper to get on the table, and we've got house cleaning to do, and we've got kids' homework to help out with. And so, you know, I might check something, I might leave the computer running, but then I won't get back to it for a while. Weekends, different matter. If we don't have anything going on, well, I could be on for 4 or 5 hours on a weekend if it's a lazy day. But we haven't had any lazy days in the last couple months, so hard to say. But a lot. That's probably the right answer. Hold on. That's a 24. But before that, oh, God, where's my pause button? Jesus, Mike, that's why you're supposed to take regular drinks as you go through the podcast. Instead of letting your throat dry out, I just hacked up a lung. I am so sorry. That was terrible. Also, I'm getting sick. So if you're listening to this podcast, don't put it in your mouth because I don't want to give you anything. But I'm coming down with some upper respiratory thing that my kids just got over, and I think it's my turn, and it's like a month-long thing. So my voice, if my voice is off today, that's why, and if my voice is off for the next 3 or 4 weeks, yeah, that's why. We'll see. Anyway, it doesn't matter. 24. 24 is from Zimney Pot. And Zimney says, I don't remember what number we're up to. Zimney says, have you ever played a hive mind character? We've already done that one. Why do I not delete these things? Well, let's get rid of that one. And go. 64. Let's see. 64 is... it's from Ronster. Does having tires filled with pure 100% nitrogen do anything for your tires that 78% nitrogen air doesn't? I know I've looked this up at one point, but I'm going to tell you, no. No, not at all. I mean, honestly. But having nitrogen inside of your tires instead of air, are your tires subject to corrosion from the inside if you've got oxygen in there? Because, okay, if you've got tires that are subject to corrosion, if they will oxidize, then, oh, yeah, definitely keep the oxygen out, and that way they'll only rust on the outside. But I don't see that happening to my tires. Does 100% nitrogen make them lighter or heavier? I mean, and if it does it make any difference that's measurable against the, I don't know, whenever I put a tank of gas in and I'm adding 160 pounds to it? I mean, does that, I think it's crap. I honestly think it's a gimmick that, hey, look, nitrogen tanks are super, super cheap, and if we tell people that we're putting nitrogen in their tires, they'll think it's awesome. I think it's garbage. I'm with you, man. At least I assume I'm with you, because it sounds like you don't think nitrogen does anything either, just from the sarcastic tone you used when you wrote this question. So I'm going to guess that you're on my side here. But you know what? That is the end of this podcast. I didn't realize what time it was. Oh, and that's Train. Hi, Train. So, you know what? I'm going to pause it here, and we're going to let GLaDOS do a recap for us. Go on, GLaDOS.
Remember when the platform was sliding into the fire pit and I said goodbye, and you were like,
no way.
And then I was all, we pretended we were going to murder you.
That was great.
This podcast is copyright 2014 by Nerd Pride Radio. The opening and closing theme is Death Metal Disco by Ian Kronk. My bumper music this week is Weezer's In the Garage, Wonderful World by Sam Cooke. She Blinded Me with Science? I don't think I did a science. Nah, skip that one. I think that's it. And all of these songs are available on iTunes. Check them out. Buy them. Enjoy them. I wouldn't include them in my podcast if I didn't love them. If you want to do something nice for this podcast, recommend it to a friend. If you enjoy it, then spread the word and let other people enjoy it. That is what you can do for me. Don't forget to check out the free games I have available on my free games page. Instant Game, Animal Ball Melee, Sandbox Hill, 2/3 of a dozen others, all free, all the time. If you want to contact me, you can always email me at mike@nerdprideradio.com. I promise I will actually respond to you. You can find me on Twitter, where my handle is @nerdprideradio, or even check out my Facebook page at facebook.com/nerdprideradio. But to be totally honest, say it with me, the best way to talk to me is to come sign up for my forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums. Sign up, send me a message, we will hang out together, we'll be best friends, we'll have fun. Oh no, I forgot to put up the I'm recording post. I have nothing from the listeners, and there's no after party and no listener betrayal. I'm so sorry. So instead, R2's going to have to cover for me. 68. Let's do one last one here. 68 says, mark that one. Oh, it's from Kyle. Kyle says, is there any purpose in standard transmissions anymore in consumer cars, not trucks? Are they just a relic for people who want to feel like manly men when they drive? Probably. I guess so. I mean, I don't know that I get any. I know for a fact that my gas mileage is way better on an automatic than it is on a standard transmission. And my gas mileage is even better when I put it on cruise control as opposed to fixing my speed myself. Because clearly, in every case, my car is a better driver than I am. Like I say, I'm begging for the day when my car's going to be able to nag me about my driving. Mike, you might want to switch lanes. Hey, Mike, there's a stop sign coming up. Hey, did you see that truck? Yeah, I saw it, but I'll be safer. Annoyed, but safer. So, I don't think in a regular passenger vehicle, I don't think there's any good reason for a standard transmission. I mean, for me, it just means I've got a clutch that I can wear out a lot faster. I'm not interested in that at all. I mean, I learned on a standard transmission. My first two cars were stick shift, and once I finally got myself an automatic, I was so grateful for it. I would much rather have an automatic vehicle. I mean, I can drive a stick. That's not the issue. I would just rather not. It's one more thing to think about, one more thing that I can break. I don't want to do that. So I don't know. I mean, if you're a really good driver, I'm guessing if I asked Earl about this, Earl would tell me that, no, you want to get the best out of your vehicle. You need to be in control. You need to, all right, whatever. I'm sure there's lots of people that will disagree with me, but no, not for me. You know, give me an automatic any day, man. And that's it. Say goodnight, R2.